Historically, concrete and conjecture. And the essay within that book forward is indeed a very entertaining and in some ways thought-provoking set of suggestions. So, in the context of asking in historical circumstances, suppose in Gettysburg had gone one way, suppose in the Battle of Britain had gone one way, or any other political historical circumstance. But the other thing which I do enjoy, because I go to the United States quite frequently, and one of the nice things, which is slightly less emphasized by essays in Scotland, is that in the United States you can engage in same shameless self-publicity and self-glorification and self-aggregation. In the very great policy, I draw attention to a recent work here. This has been out for some years, and the argument, as a few of you may know, is that in fact, I think, the humanness is an inevitability, but on the other hand, paradoxically, it may well be that we are completely alone. Now, the one other aspect about the ground floor, if you like, the evolution, which is sometimes neglected, again, I'll go through this very quickly, but it is that though much emphasis has been given on the emergence of complexity, aka the Darwinian eye, is sometimes forgotten that all the basic molecular building blocks of the eye, and actually to a large extent also the brain, have evolved billions of years before the eye or the brain has itself appeared. So to render a tissue transparent, to render a tissue which can transfer photons into an electrical signal, can require particular proteins which themselves evolve for different purposes in different contexts and have been recruited, which is very much the case in evolution. From that perspective, one would not be totally surprised to see the emergence of eye per se. They're really not very difficult to build at all. However, it is claimed, and apparently with some justice, that there are a number of unique evolutionary features. One of the best known examples is that taken from Jared Darwin to do with the evolution of the woodpecker. A woodpecker is, as we say in the trade, monophyletic, and it's an extraordinarily highly designed piece of equipment, not least its ability to perch, using a stiff tail and its famous reverse claw. But more clearly, as you can see here, it's trying to knock itself out while it's extracting insects from the bark. We also know it has a remarkable skull bone, which has been argued by Jared Darwin, because this is a unique feature, why not humans being unique, especially those who have built radio telescopes? Well, he might be right, but curious enough, even though Jared Darwin is an ornithologist and a great respect, it's curious that he mentioned that the woodpecker-like form evolved independently of these two other kinds, notably in Cunarid, which is near tropical birds, and there there's a rather precise conversion between the skull structure, which prevents an animal knocking itself out, and the Cunarid, which was a deeply living hellhound of insects in South America. Now, in terms of convergence, which is really the leitmotif of what I want to say, again, this will be a fairly familiar example, but I think it's one that's quite powerful, to do with how similar things might be. To deal with two groups of mammals, the first group of mammals, which many of you biologists will be familiar with, centers, they would have a cow, and when the girl grows up, she becomes pregnant, she would of course have approximately 9 months gestation period. That's in marked contrast to another group of mammals, known as marsupials. Up at the top here, we have daddy, and there's very reason you should please themselves, because the fallopian is his favorite. The embryo of the marsupial is born at a far earlier stage, and of course inhabits a characteristic pouch which defines the marsupial of the group itself. In many other respects, these animals differ quite markedly. However, if we then look at particular aspects of fossil record, we find, unsurprisingly, that cat-like forms appear, and typically they accentuate their canine to produce a stabbing structure, which is epitomized in the state of two cats. If we reconstruction these two cats here, we actually see that the lower cat there is one which we've been familiar, even in Scotland, with living memory, almost, and corresponding with one of our other ones lived in South America. Both are extinct, as a number of you will know quite well now. These two cats only share one significant difference. The upper one is in fact a marsupial, the lower one is a placental. Put that bluntly, the lower one is far more closely related to a raccoon or a hedgehog or a giraffe, and the upper one is far more closely related to a wombat or a kangaroo than they are to each other. Therefore, that degree of similarity is quite striking. There are two things worth emphasizing just at this point. The first is that indeed the vocabulary which comes with the description of convergence by mainstream biologists wearing white coats and having two fronts was always actually just a surprise. Words like uncanny, remarkable, striking are routinely used. It seems to be extremely peculiar. Another aspect is that never are convergences precise. In this particular case, my vertical paleontologist friends become extremely irritated at this stage and say, no signs, all sorts of differences in hoofs, painful skeleton. They're really not the same though. And my answer to that, I'm afraid to tell you, is it really makes no difference in
my opinion, clearly, even if I can't talk with you, even if I can't, really doesn't matter. Now, in terms of convergence, before I concentrate on the evolution of sensory systems and thereby how to provide the case of sentience and intelligence, it's worth stressing that such examples, although less widely known, actually span the whole of biology. In principle, molecular convergence, as illustrated here, would be thought to be very rare, unlikely, because after all, as many of you know, have a large number of building blocks, a protein 20 different amino acids, a few from, not particularly up to camels, but pretty wide choice, and a protein might have up to 1,000 or more amino acids. So, as an astronomically large number, actually super astronomically large number of alternatives. So to find molecular convergence could indeed be very, very few. In fact, if I saw an identical sequence and I found it that they came from a particularly unrelated group, I would become an intelligent science person immediately. But I won't, and now will you. In particular, the convergence is a lot more precise, and I'll give you one of many examples. Because we are carbon-based life forms, we have to retain our carbon. And nature is so arranged that it's locked up in a rather intractable molecule known as carbon dioxide. That's where the carbon lies, on Mars, on Venus, on this planet. So to exploit that carbon dioxide, somehow we have to cleave it. And nature has devised an extraordinary, remarkable enzyme, a natural catalyst called carbonic anhydrase. Now my intuition would be that given that we all share our ancestors, given we all use carbon, we would all have exactly the same carbonic anhydrase. It should be primitive. But rather remarkably, this enzyme has evolved independently at least four times. Why and when and for what reason are in fact completely under-investigated. So where does the convergence lie? Well, here we have three examples of the four, and the tiny blue dots are actually the area of convergence. They are precisely identical. They involve the zinc atom and typically three histidine residues surrounding that atom. And that is the way you hydrate carbon dioxide. What is so important about this, I think, is it begins to confirm a predictability of biology, which has traditionally been in the reign of physics and chemistry. Biology doesn't have laws, biology is made of exceptions. Biology is for people who don't like test tubes. Not in that case at all. Here I would suggest that this similarity is so astonishing that there's almost no doubt that everywhere in the universe you will be using carbonic anhydrase, either fundamental or predictability. Let me take an example from the opposite end of the spectrum. There we go. The little early one of these, I grant you, but nevertheless. In terms of behaviour, it turns out that again the similarity between the way that we get intoxicated and the way in which fruit flies do is remarkably similar. You see, the thing about fruit flies is they have to deal with a substrate which tends to rot and produce alcohols. They therefore have very protection against alcohol. But on the other hand, living in an alcohol-rich environment has, as you well know, its own dangers. So what you do in the experimental process, and believe me, this is completely true, is you design a little experimental rig which is known as the inebriometer. And you put in about 500 fruit flies into each individual cell. And every time the leg crosses a light beam, it registers. And the drunker the fly gets, the more the legs move. So what we see in this curve here, and I'm sorry, I can't stay for more 3 months here, is that when you introduce the flies into this alcohol-saturated environment, and then compare it to our behaviour in a cocktail party, there's immediately a roar of conversation. That then tails off, and simply the legs of the fruit flies stop moving so rapidly. There's minor panic in the area, because there's no sign of waiters, let alone cocktail. But relief is soon at hand, because thereafter as conversation dips again, or leg movements begin to decline, then they increase the second time, at least in the fruit flies, the alcohol continues to poison more and more, so they turn towards terminal intoxication and ultimately death. And in that particular respect, the behaviour we see, the behaviour of the fruit fly is strongly convergent with human intoxication. Now, with respect to these various sorts of convergences, another thing which is very important to emphasise, because we tend to be so dazzled by the diversity of life, is in point of fact, in many cases, the differences are completely skin deep. Being one type of deep similarity between land and sharks, and tuna uses exactly that method. But let me take an even more extreme example than the octopus, which I'll come back to in a moment. What could be more alien than the octopus is its flailing arms and all the rest. This is a point of fascination to H.G. Wells in particular, who would regard these animals, and that's why we populated those tripods of Mars with rubber octopus-like creatures, as utterly alien. In point of fact, if you look at the arms themselves, and in particular see that they, the way they operate to grab a piece of food, say a piece of shrimp, if they're given, one actually sees in point of fact
that the arm breaks itself into a series of pseudo-joints, which precisely mimic the way our arms construct themselves. The joints are actually produced by muscle waves moving in opposite directions until they meet. The crucial thing to appreciate is that the whole biomechanics of that apparently flexible tentacle is exactly the same as our arm, and indeed there's a wonderful throwaway remark in the secondary nature, which says not only is this the optimum solution, but it may be the only solution. So even when things look wildly different, in point of fact, they can be far more similar than you realise. Now, when we move on to the evolution of sensory systems, which is a thing which I think is the most interesting area in many respects, because that presumably in some ways reaches sentience of consciousness, amongst others, the inclination to discover things beyond the visible in particular, then it here turns out to have a number of very intriguing similarities in terms of convergence, which is quite well known. We, of course, are descendants of the fish. We have camera eyes, as indeed they do. They stay in the water, we came out. But it also is very well known, the camera eyes that you see in the group of cephalopods, which is the squid and the octopus, are strikingly similar to the camera eyes we see in ourselves. And if you're not completely up to date with molecular biology, take it from me that both fossil record, molecular biology itself, and anatomy and embryology, convincingly to demonstrate that we are closely related to starfish, and that's closely related to a brachiopod. And there's no chance of that common ancestor living at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion actually possessing a camera eye. So if you take a cross section through these, you'll see that they are indeed slightly similar. Not identical. There's always an evolution in footprint. The position of the retina in particular is simply reversed enough because we are retina pathways of the brain, the retina of the mollus, in contrast to the instinct in the ectoderm, which becomes neurogenic. However, what is slightly less appreciated is that this camera-like eye evolved independently. At least three times as shown here, in a relatively early contact, seven times. And in almost every case, the animal which possesses the camera eye tends to like meat, it tends to move fast, and it tends to be intelligent. That's a pretty interesting combination. There are something like 40 different sorts of eye, which Dawkins, one of his books, tends to landscape, which look like land ideas, and indeed it is the case that there are many sorts of eyes. The fact of the matter is that on this planet, if you go for a walk, you're almost certainly observed either through somebody else's camera eye, octopus, or through the main terms of the compound eye. The compound eye itself is evolved independently at least four times. Best known, of course, is in the insects. But the compound eye suffers various disadvantages. After all, you can only make the lenses of a certain size too small for the impact of light. You can only pack so many lenses in. The eye itself has the Euclidean surface that cannot be increased in a three-dimensional world. You can then ask the thought, you can do a thought experiment and say, well, suppose you've got a very fit camera eye, and everybody has the same journey. Everybody you know now has a compound eye. What sort of size of eye would we require to enjoy the vision acuity which the great majority of us do? The answer is, even after a very strong given point, is sobering. In fact, you need an eye that's quite across. And again, I think it's important, it's just for the carbonic anhydrase, there's a predictability here. Basically, as and when the extraterrestrials arrive, as and when the flying saucer comes down, and as when the rat crashes down, and the empathy-free aliens fan across the city with laser cannons, destroying everything in front of them. If they're coming towards you with a camera eye, then you run away extremely quickly. If they're coming towards you with a compound eye, don't worry, they're not dangerous at all. Now, these aspects of the sentience, the processing information, the basic business of sense experience, the basic question about how we actually know anything, how we make sense of anything, again, find some striking parallels. Those of you in the United States or Canada will recognize the skull nose mold, these of you in Europe that are now extinct. And this is quite well known, the nose, of course, is human to function, you can see the two nostrils, but the surrounding area has been transformed into a highly tactile organ. The Kentucky brilliantly shown, the whole neurobiology of this nose is remarkably similar to an eye. It can actually effectively see through its nose. And of course, as soon as you think about it, there's nothing particularly surprising about this. After all, you aren't seeing anything at all. Your sense of experience has been introduced, transduced, from the external signal to something which is then interpreted within the brain. So in principle, you may find that the actual wiring which enables you to understand the world can be arrived at effectively independently towards the same endpoint. And that, again, emphasizes the extraordinary concentration of the nervous tissue, both in the forearm, in fact, and also in the nose itself, which allows this animal to live in what is ostensibly a particularly sensory world, but in point of fact, is remarkably similar to our own. And such examples go even further afield, so we see that many fish in particular, the electric eel, torpedo, but also the so-called weakly electric fish, which independently has involved electro generation both here in
apocryphically, most official of all marriage and corresponding in South America.
Again, it's taking too far afield, I'm afraid, but it's clear that not only do these animals live in effectively a completely electrical world, which allows them to navigate in social darkness, which allows them to communicate, engage in courtship, to engage in sexual selection, and many other aspects. But in point of fact, in many respects, they are living not only in an electrical world, but a world which, in a number of ways, is much more similar to our visual world, including possibly even an analogy to colour, which one could first expect. So all this matters very much indeed, because after all, we pride our own intelligence, we pride our sentience, we pride our ability to understand the world around us. But it's popular to suppose, and it's been encapsulated in the famous essay by Thomas and Gale, What Would Life Have Reminded of That, that no bats have completely alien minds. Well, I may yet be correct, obviously, simply to speak to these creatures, but when you know the scientists have to ask the right question, the whole new universe is literally open up, and that may be true here as well. It would seem quite possible that the basic substrate of mentality is universal because it's convergent, both within systems, eyes, between systems, and for instance, I could give you similar examples of action, or feeling, or taste, which are equally impressed by things in that respect. So if mentality is universal, based, of course, on the molecular substrate, but perhaps going far beyond that molecular substrate, then I think it can be quite encouraged, or can be. Because after all, to suggest that something like myself is real rather than general biological properties such as vision or olfaction, it seems to be perhaps pushing the boat down too far. But I might be able to persuade you that even something like this on a far remote planet is not as improbable as the first it takes once again as a convergence. So we live on planets which occasionally rather strange things happen. Why do we know that this particular diagram is actually impossible? Why were dinosaurs together domesticated? And I should say, I'm not sure if some of the people are listening here, but very unworthily, I do call this the graduation ceremony in Oxford. You see all those dinosaurs over there. Here's old Richard, by the way, and the small pterodactyl over there. He's going in the right direction at last, and then I'm going to another story. But very important. But the reason why we know this is out of the question, of course, is because 65 million years ago, on June day, some cloud drops a huge rock on the sky, and the great reptiles, not only on land, but in the sea, and on the sky, in the sky, are rendered extinct. And had that not happened, again, as Stephen Jay Gould repeatedly emphasized, then we would not have the opportunity for radiation for mammals in particular, so the air would not have been reinvaded by the bats, the ocean would not have been reinvaded by the whales, and of course the trees would not have been invaded by the primates, some of them suddenly came down. Great apes and ourselves, and thereby evolution went in a completely new direction due to a chance impact between a rather small lump of rock and the Earth 65 million years ago. But I think, in fact, that's unlikely to have any particular relevance. The reason is perfectly straightforward, because Earth-like planets, we have reason to think, given their carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, given their conveyor belts and an oceanic system, cannot avoid the ice ages. And they can't back to a world where the asteroid misses, because we don't have to worry too much. What would happen is in the temporal polar zones, those animals who coexisted with dinosaurs, they're called birds and mammals, by the way, were able to take the opportunity because they're more intelligent, they're more sociable, as I showed you, and they're more propensity independently to invent technology. And if you invent an independently of technology, then I'm afraid the days of the dinosaurs would be numbered in any set of circumstances. In other words, this mass extinction we had simply accelerated an inevitable process. My guess is by about 30 million years. And it turns the fact that when we look at the birds in particular, that the convergence that we see between them and mammals are far more striking than we feel quite recently appreciated. Again, I go through this very quickly, quite familiar, especially to biologists. Their warm-bloodedness is shown in causing the attendance of the horse. Their warm-bloodedness is independent. Birds have learned to sing independently three times, but in point of fact, not only is that true, but also their neurobiology is in, and their behavior, the way they learn their songs, the shooting by the males in particular, badly plays on the line. Also being arrived at independently from the mating arrangements. We'll skip that in a rather large file. Another thing which we take completely for granted, but until only recently has come clearly to light, is what we define as social play, which is very widespread in the mammals. In point of fact, it evolved on a one-to-one basis of exact correlation in the more intelligent of the birds, especially in the parrots and also the crows. Here we have the high altitude parrot in New Zealand and pair. The care, especially young, enjoying mock wrestling up the top cover wall, and there is on the outside there, you can the delinquent teenagers, they go around with gangs trashing things. So the aspects of this social play are augmented by one other aspect, which is very clear in prose in particular, but that the other group would be performed on. And that is that they are extraordinarily adept at making tools. New Caledonian prose is just an example of this, both in the wild they make the prose, and also here in the laboratory in the German Institute of Lab in Oxford, we see that they are very versatile in their inventiveness of this sort of tool making. Why this is so important is tool making not only involves the construction of different sorts of tools and different sorts of purposes, but this progressive manipulation for those different functions. This is a proto technology. This tool making is far in advance of what chimpanzees can do, and it's been arrived at completely independently. Recall the sort of stone tools we were making about 2 million years ago. Well, they're frankly much better than this. They could have time machine back 2 million years and said, well, by the way, the point of the moon will be there in 2 million years' time. They, of course, would have taken it up to the dark. So what it turns out to be the case is that on the basis of vocalisation, tool-making and other aspects of complex behaviour, as has been shown in a number of cases, but especially in the prose, the cognitive world which the bird makes themselves matches one-to-one in a convergent fashion with the cognitive world that we see in the creatures themselves. And why I find this so fascinating is that quite recently it's been realised that though there's been attempts to homologise rather precisely the similarities between the bird brain and the mammal brain, in point of fact, the bird brain is constructed in a completely different way. It has a nucleic structure and has very few specific similarities, especially in the areas where the higher functions support are based. So that raises a very interesting question. Is convergence, well, is the basis actually on molecular core? Well, that makes me. But if it's not that, then what are we actually in? For what are we actually thinking out of it? I see some possibility, as I mentioned right at the end of this talk, that there are other ways we can begin to address this problem. And correspondingly, even in the case of the more intelligent birds, they tend to have slightly larger brains. If we look at the hominid increase of those birds, which is indeed utterly spectacular, and has been claimed repeatedly to be unique, the point that that increase in brain size was achieved independently of the dolphins. And not only that, as I showed you, you know, the cognitive world of the primate there on one side and the dolphin on the other side are again highly convergent. But indeed, although we're so impressed with our increased brain size, it has outstripped now all other species. We have a brain that is roughly 7 times too big for our bodies, and it's consuming metabolically something like 75% of your breakfast, which is metabolic disaster. If you look at this diagram here, what you see is, in point of fact, the red dot showing increase of brain size in humans only about 1.5 million years ago, which we called half the goal, so prior to that, of maintaining large brains for something like 10 to 15 million years before that. And if you look at the dolphin, we see the tools, the sponges on the rostra, or the natural blood, for example, and more particularly, the whole cognitive world that we investigated from things such as semantic and syntactic ability to understand instructions, their ability to memorize things, their ability to recognize themselves in mirrors. In many, many respects, we see that these things, again, converge remarkably closely to us. So you say, well, that's very surprising. They're mammals, aren't they? They wake up, or they wake up. Well, possibly so, but of course, that in some ways, the convergence of the crow would be less surprising because we're living in trees for the first approximation. But if you're living in an oceanic environment, the large depends on echolocation, which was independent of the birds and cats, would suggest that back there, the cognitive world would not be the same, but the same cognitive world emerges. Now, I want to say a few other brief things about the way in fact we underestimate animal sentience, so this could be true of. The first is actually to do with our friend the dogs here. I can't resist telling the story. This is a story from Scotland. In the war, a Norwegian trawler escaped the invading Nazis and came across the Dundee, where it was re-equipped as a armed trawler. Came on board his last dog here, Bamser. Bamser became rather famous, but Bamser was very fond of his crew, and he went to the crew with a spring lead and then come back reeking of alcohol some hours later. Bamser decided he'd go down to the bus stop to wait for the crew to come back. They did, of course. Then Bamser decided it would be more sensible to go into town and look for them themselves. So Bamser got his head again on the bus and then going around the town to find his friends and then bringing them home. So when old Memphis Bamser became any of his excursions, he pointed out that people there, the group of course very fond of him, eventually gave his dog an honorary bus pass. I think again and again it turns out that in terms of having sentiment of animal complexity, there are untold depths of understanding. I don't mean to be sentimental here at all. These things are biologically and convergently important. This is no more true, I think, than with respect to the elephants, for a number of reasons. First of all, their extraordinary trunks may have been their motive for intelligence, because the curious thing about the elephants is
do not act disproportionately by our friends. There are a lot of friends with a lot of animals. But the trunk of the oven could pick up a grain of rice. This precise manipulation might be an exact analogy to why we became intelligent, because, of course, sex was most of all sex and social relations. The vital things are infants and brain size, was due to that sort of thing, and we see them doing two things rather than one. But it may, in point of fact, be much more to do with manipulation. The end of the trunk itself, you may know, actually, was certainly originally short. It evolved in an aquatic ancestor. But more particularly, when we look at them, we see two very interesting groups. First of all, they're deck pool makers. They have to be parasitic flies. They thought they do is they make these branches here, which they switch around, and the blood loss in parasitic flies is serious. The great advantage of this sort of tool, of course, is that having used it, you can eat it. Another thing which has been established quite recently with most of humans, like dolphins, bonobos, possibly parrots and ourselves, but otherwise almost unknown, is that elephants are capable of self-recognition. You can notice the elephants right there, the mark on the experiment of Bronx Zoo. That business of self-recognition, that business of self-personality and self-identity, which we take completely for granted, is actually very mysterious indeed, but certainly evolves in a virgin thing. The most interesting thing, perhaps especially for people here, given that we know that we must go to death, is that the elephants, among very few other species, show a remarkable interest not only in skeletal remains only of their own species, not other species, especially their ivory, but also the response to death, not only by the closely related members here, we have the dying men, the matriarch, who's been actually shortly about to be lifted up, but in point of fact, in a number of other instances where the unrelated clans come to visit this thing, there is a curious and specific emotional response to the death of especially the matriarchs, and also they're very young. Well, in a certain sense, they won't make it, but on the other hand, I think it's a hint that if you're going to go onto the edges of the metaphysical world, you must not be surprised that they're visited by groups which at first sight would think you're too ponderous to be involved in such excursions. So, really, to wrap up very quickly indeed, if I might have a couple more minutes, what I wanted to now stress is that even despite saying all that, the best of my knowledge, a number of us were disengaged in worship about some half an hour ago, and in other respects, as I like to use this diagram here, what other species would regard this as a sensible thing to do? yes, I can tell you a good Jewish joke as well, but we'll move on to it before that. The aspect here is that my argument is effectively twofold. That when you get to a particular level of organisation, then you'll find that the things back in the pre-Cambrian which would be inconceivable actually become inevitable. There are two or three ways in the minutes I go through this also very quickly. The first is when we look at the Neanderthal, the one shown there on the left with a prominent eyebrow, which is almost certainly a separate species, diverging from us more than half a million years ago. Capable of precise manipulation, shown here with a Neanderthal finger and thumb. But more particularly, we know that not only did they have fire, more certain clothing, and advanced tool cultures, but they also varied, intriguingly, in a way that even elephants sort of sometimes suggest varied something that indicates Neanderthals they're dead, which we've no idea why. But more particularly, we can suppose that their late stage cultural efflorescences are the result, living as they did in Europe, of contact with incoming Homo sapiens moving in from near Asia and from advanced. This so-called chapel growing factory is intuitively made by Neanderthals and indicates an advanced extra somatic ability to convey information as well as being sexually made in chambers, who knows. But nevertheless, that is now thought to be far more likely to be completely independent and not the result of trading or theft or reputation of Homo sapiens. The stratigraphy and the cultures which precede them suggest that they did it by themselves. And the reason why I think this is so fascinating is that those sorts of stories are rerun when you look at the archaeological record in Australia. Because Australia is particularly fascinating. It was colonised by modern humans. There are no Neanderthals there at all. But when you look at their cultural development, actually very little happens, as is true for Neanderthals, as is true for Homo sapiens in other parts of the world, until about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. So this is the late Mungo skeleton, a rather primitive burial, nothing very fancy, about 40,000 years old. About 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, to put it in a nutshell, not only did they vastly improve their technology, they moved towards a single language with much more training, but that's the time it looks as if they discovered dream time. That's the time they suddenly go into a new metaphysical experience. Now, all of that can be explained simply by population increase. There's every reason to think that you have to make adjustments when you meet another tribe with whom you wish to somehow mate, or fight, or trade. But on the other hand, you
say, well, maybe this is also evolution's way of opening new possibilities. And you know quite the world that I'm talking about. Now, why this is so intriguing is that in terms of the archaeological evidence, what is particularly fascinating is that new discoveries may yet upset a great deal of what we know. Nearly all of you will be familiar with these extraordinary discoveries on the island of Flores in the Indonesian archipelago. Nearly all of you will be aware that the discovery of these diminished hominids are such that here we have an adult, but the brain size of that adult is less than a chimpanzee. And these so-called hobbits, we almost certainly have prior hunting and the like, are particularly intriguing for two reasons. First of all, there is now a real possibility that not only is this a distinct species, but conceivably actually comes from an Australopithecine, which otherwise have always been in Africa. So something that doesn't make sense at all is absolutely bonkers. But on the other hand, what is particularly fascinating is that if you look at their brain structure, although there's been a great deal of discussion about whether this might be some sort of microtechnic war, increasingly evidence points to the light that this is the real brain of this real different species. But what's essential to stress at the moment is that this has a brain which is quite incapable of doing the things it does. So what on earth is it doing? It has a brain smaller than a chimpanzee, yet it has fire and swords. And I think the evidence actually comes from a slightly different line. Here I'll conclude the well-known story now. And that is that just as you have convergence in many things, you also have convergence in singing. That singing, of course, can be explained in terms of the physics of sound production. But as Patricia Gray suggested in the brain essay some years ago in the Journal of Science, one could look at that in a completely different way and say the reason why the singing is the same is because it's detecting the same universal music. And if that is true for universal music, it may well be true for universal mentality. And of course, I don't have to stress to you, it's also true for universal religion. Thank you very much.
Well, there are two microphones. Questions, please. Everybody has done the three questions there today.
Yes, Professor Conrad Morris, I appreciate if you would perhaps elaborate here on some of the theological implications that you suggested in the title.
Jeff here, your talk is canceled. The theological implications are that, well, a number of implications. To begin with, just generally speaking, the idea that science is more like soul gentleness. Is extremely unlikely when stressed elsewhere. I think there's a great deal of ignorance we can enjoy unraveling. But more particularly when we go into the areas of consciousness, the sentience, the intuitions we have, the ability to actually do our thinking, it seems to me actually impossible not to invoke some effectively immaterial world. If you have some sort of immaterial world, then you're immediately back in a conversation that you've been going on for roughly the last 3,000 years. The theological implication of the fact that if indeed both worlds visible and invisible, then more than life in the world is invisible, a great deal more important, a great deal more permanent, and a great deal more interesting than the world we take for granted around ourselves. And I think in that way, all I'm saying is that evolution is a search engine for those sorts of things, and that's why it's convergent. In other words, the discovery is inevitable. It's up to us to decide what to do with that. Obviously, there are aspects about specific Christian theology, which I'm more than happy, though I'm no expert in that area, to talk about. It seems to me that again, the majority of people think we're by no means scandalous. But there's no particular difficulty per se, other than anything that's impossible to understand, the dealing with the incarnation and the resurrection. Those things entirely consistent with the world which it is as it is, rather than as some of our friends in North Oxford would like it to be.
I just had a quick question, because if things are going to converge, they must have been divergent before, in order to be then converged. So, and they diverge from something. So, when they diverge, how do you know it's really convergent and not really convergent?
That's an important question, and I think there are discussions as to what is true convergence versus what is called parallelism. But in essence, what one can show in many cases is that the common ancestor, be it in the case of the camera eye or social systems, could not possibly have possessed that particular arrangement. But I think what really matters, something to be right about just recently,
is the question to which you get in particular states which are irreversible. And there's some very good examples from youth sociality, for instance. I think that is also true, for instance, for the human experience. There's sometimes some, I think, sort of, sentimentality almost, nostalgia for somehow retreating into a sort of pre-industrial world. You can't do it. You are irreversibly locked into where we're going. There's no reason to think that isn't part of our history, going back to your point there. And one needn't be thinking panic about it. Of course, there are cases that if the things are identical or very similar, therefore they must have a common ancestry, because that's why we determine things are common. But molecular phylogenies in particular usually allow a fairly reliable determination of whether they have separate ancestors or not. It is a problem. But the cases I'm interested in, like cognitive experience again, tool making, advanced sentience, those sorts of things are clearly independent.
In reading your books and seeing your talk, I would have said it was a very straightforward theological invitation to your scientific work, but you're not articulating it yourself, and I'm wondering if I'm way off base, so just let me try to articulate it, tell me if I'm wrong. The Gould notion of rewinding and editing and everything coming out differently every time does not seem very resonant, to use Alistair McGrath's words last night, with the biblical notion that there is a purpose of creation and that purpose being creatures in God's image, in the sense not of being bilaterally symmetric and for all like predators, but in the sense of being intelligent, sentient, morally sensitive, morally responsible. But your work, which emphasizes convergence, suggests that regardless of the details of evolution, regardless of how many times you wind the clock back, that there can be some purpose. It doesn't prove to be anything like that, but it's very resonant for that. And I would say that's the greatest theological implication of your particular scientific work. And am I wrong about that? Again, am I off base for something?
No, you're not off base at all. I hope that if it unembarrassed about my own faith, so far as I can articulate it, what I'm wary about at the moment, if you like, is that with great respect, I think a number of people sort of seriously underestimate what creation is in certain ways, so going back to the point I was trying to make there. And also what I would be wary about, and I think in fact you articulated that yourself, is we're not dealing here, and I'm not for a moment suggesting we want to say that either, we're not dealing here with truths. So if you start using words like theology and so forth, that's fine and large so far as it goes. But I mean, again, thinking about this in the last few months, it strikes me that if you look, say, at the nature miracles, for example, or if you look at the experience of the resurrection experience and how that benefits the spectrum of opinion there, it seems that one way to think about it is not to think about it, because there is no vocabulary capable of understanding what those people saw. You're incapable of understanding it. It's man over the evil. So in that sort of respect, again, in a certain way, I think it's true also based on science stuff. When you're on the agency of scientific understanding, the normalization is mentioned in the present, in those particular cases, then in point of fact, you are struggling to articulate something, which actually, in fact, goes back to some very interesting, deep questions to do with your origin of our language and your origin of our poetry, and that's a particular story that I'm very much influenced by the idea of the Roman Bible, for example. So, what I am really aware about, but I find intensely impressing, I'm afraid to say, for a lot of the American scene that's doing fine here as well, and in Australia, is the thing mentioned in passing to do with intelligence, and we'll hear about that. But the general idea that, is that we are in charge. Somehow, now we can talk about it, the Jews, yes, have a particular genius in that, but nevertheless, the general thing is that, we are making the world as we like, and people say, well, they're wrong, it's not like that at all. All bets are off. So, yes, it's there, if you like, but I wouldn't want to use this in a way which might be employed by some people to sort their politics.
Well, it's simply a matter of consistency. It's simply a matter of intellectual consistency and resonance. I find that the resonance also between the Big Bang and the sort of tradition, right? It doesn't prove anything, but it's open to
everything. Yeah. Now, the trouble is that it may be that the high mechanics, the viscosity of gravity, the unfavorable forces themselves and strange these designs in the air. So it would be unfortunate to shut up and do about.
Absolutely.
Now, first speaker yesterday said that we should share everything, and that includes people sharing time. So, unfortunately,